when I saw this image, I had this flashback when I was a young kid. We would always go on family hikes. I lived in Massachusetts, just south of Boston. We'd drive anywhere between 2 to 3 hours north, sometimes longer, to get to a mountain to hike. And we always had fun. And last Sunday, I preached about the whole, you know, getting ready for the hike. And this one particular time that we were hiking, I was of the age now where I didn't have to hang out with my parents while I was hiking. I could hang out with my siblings. I'm the youngest of four. And so my siblings and I, we took off up the trail, right? And it was, you know, maybe a three-hour hike. Not a big deal, right? So we sprint up the trail, and we're like, bye, Mom and Dad, see ya. And we come to this fork in the road. Mom? But my brother says, I know which way to go. We've hiked it 100 times, and we went this way. You know it. Oh, that was the wrong direction to go. We were supposed to have kept going straight up that trail, but instead we went this other trail, winding our way, and soon that trail just like disappeared. It was like this sheer rock. This is New England's sheer rock that we came to, and we could see where we're supposed to be, but that's not where we were. And I remember at one moment, my siblings were up here, and we just had this moment of fear, but then we collected ourselves. We collected ourselves, and we looked at each other, and we said, okay, what do we think is the best path for us to get back to Mom and Dad, back to that top of that mountain that we are seeking, that we are needing to be at? And so collectively, we wounded our way from winding trails and uncertain markers to eventually we found Mom and Dad. They were already at the top, waiting for us, a little nervous, but we were rejoined. And I hadn't thought about that for a while until I saw this image of that path. Then there's times of uncertainty where our path suddenly take a change in course. We need to rely on God's Spirit and on community and hanging in there with each other because we've got a goal. We know where we want to be. Sometimes our paths will take a sudden shift in how we're going to get there, but we will get there. This morning's scripture comes from Matthew's gospel. It's the 9th chapter, verses 35 to 38. Then Jesus went about all the cities and the villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the realm of God, and curing every disease and every sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into the harvest." I've been a pastor now for 26 years, and I have never preached on this pericope. There have been plenty of passages where I've not only preached once or twice, probably 10 times on, but I have never preached on this little pericope of a few sentences in Matthew's gospel. Now, just a few months ago, this church, we had a Bible study on the gospel of Matthew, and I don't know if the team remembers, but did I spend much time on this traveling agenda of Jesus's? No, there's no theology here. There's no theophany. This is just, I woke up at 8, had a late morning, had some fish maybe by the Sea of Galilee for breakfast, and then went on my way. But there's such wonders in this passage. And again, I thank the author John Indermark for bringing this passage up in his book that I've been reading lately, Praying the Paths of Jesus, as it's called. See, what Jesus is doing here is he's going throughout the villages and the cities. Only at the end of his journey does he go to Jerusalem. He stays out of Jerusalem the whole time because he's out and about being busy. He's out and about visiting people, and he's preaching. And what is he preaching? Is he preaching about the do's and don'ts, the rules, the book of Leviticus? No, he's preaching the good news. What's the good news? The good news that Jesus was preaching is that God loves you. God empowers you. Not only just you as an individual, but you as a community. That we cannot do a spiritual life by ourselves. Yes, Jesus would go on the mountaintops every now and then to get away, to get a little sabbatical, get a little rest. But then he went back down into community. And community is the core principle of church. So his preaching of the good news was about God's amazing unconditional love that God has for all of us, even the least of these. Male, female, Jew, Gentile, nationalized citizen or foreigner, didn't matter in God's eye. That's the good news. And then it shows how Jesus had compassion for the harassed and the helpless. Think about that. Who in our culture, in our communities, in your lives right now are the harassed and the helpless? Do you feel harassed and helpless in your lives? And if so, where do you get your respite? Where do you get your nourishment? Where is your staff that you can lean on? Where is your community? Where is your God that allows you to lean? Maybe for a moment, maybe for a day, maybe for a week, to lean on God. Now, in this particular pericope, it wasn't John Indermark's intent to focus on what I just did, on that idea of Jesus going from city to city, about preaching the good news, about having compassion. This was a man who loved people. He didn't care if you were the mayor or a prostitute. He loved you because he sat and he looked in your eyes and he wanted to hear your story. This is what the church should be doing, taking the time to look in your eyes, to hear your story. And then how, as a community, do we come together to go out into the harvest, because it is plentiful out into the fields, and to work together, to be laborers together? What John Indermark does with this little pericope here, he talks about how we are these harvesters. We are the ones to go out into the world. And he writes this, that when we go out into the world, we carry our experience of God's presence and our conversation with the heart of God into the places where we conduct our businesses, where we raise our families, where we enjoy leisure, engage in social and political involvements, and refresh ourselves in friendship. This, to me, is the crux of the gospel. We aren't to leave God on the mountaintop. We aren't to leave God here in worship, wrapped in our hymns and our prayers. We are to take our experience and the conversations that we are having with the heart of God and bring it into our businesses, bring it into our families, bring it into how we vacation, to engage in social and political involvements, and to refresh ourselves in friendship. How many of you have friends that agree with you 100%? I don't. So friendship isn't about agreeing all the time. It's about engaging in real conversation with the knowledge that this person cares for me. This person loves me no matter what. All right, if you burn their lasagna, maybe then there's a limit to that. And I wondered, as Jesus was growing up, what was the lamp that guided his journey? What was the lamp that guided him? These lamppost moments as he was journeying from birth. Where was Jesus born? Bethlehem. All right, going from, I did know that. I was just
just testing you.
Where he was born in Bethlehem, and then he's on this journey, right? It's not a straight line like I have right here, but it was like a windy thing, right? What were the lampposts? Where were the markers in his life's journey? Spiritual and emotional, political, ideological. What were the lampposts? Where were these moments that helped Jesus see beyond the barriers and boundaries of race and gender, of religion, of sexual orientation? What helped him go beyond those boundaries to see how we are all united? What were those elements? We don't know. We can only imagine. It was his wrestling with scriptures, his arguing with the rabbis, his engagement with his family and his friends. He was observing life. And as he grew in wisdom, as the scriptures talk about, some people, as they acquire more accreditation, more degrees, more experience, they kind of have this like, I have an MDiv, okay? I know how to run the church. Yeah! But Jesus didn't. Jesus wasn't about those airs, because then John Indermark brings in this other gospel that I didn't see coming. Totally didn't see coming, as he equated this idea of Jesus taking a moment. This is from Matthew a little bit later on. Then little children were being brought to Jesus in order that he may lay hands on them and pray. The disciples spoke sternly to those who brought them, but Jesus said, "Let the children come unto me, and do not stop them. For it is to such as these that the realm of God belongs." And he laid hands on them, and he went on his way. What John Indermark does right here by bringing these two texts, one that I've never preached on and one that I've preached on so many times in my 26 years of ministry, never saw this connection between these two. He's talking about, listen, there are interruptions. There are moments of unplanned stops in our journey. Are you attuned to them? So here was Jesus. He was a busy man, right? He had a lot to do in those, you know, year or 3 years, depending on which gospel you read, of stuff to do. He's like, I've got a lot of stuff to do before I got to go down to Jerusalem. And so he's a busy man. He's going through all the villages and cities, right? He's traveling around. He's healing. He's speaking. And our next guest preacher is Jesus. You know, he's a busy man. His calendar is full. But then there's an interruption. And the little children are being brought to him. And most people would have just been like, oh, come on, I don't have time for these kids. But Jesus made time. He interrupted his program. He interrupted his schedule so that he could be present for these children. Much like there are images of the Pope that I see every now and then where he does the exact same thing. A little child comes up to him and he takes time. He looks at that child. He feels their love or their sadness or their compassion, and he takes time. So imagine what that does to that child when you're taking time to listen. I'll get to that meeting in a moment, okay? Right now, I'm just listening to this child. Many, many years ago, when my father had finished his medical school training and done his internship and his residency in anesthesiology, he finally made it to the big times. He found a private practice in California, moved the family from Massachusetts to California, started this private practice that allowed him to work from the early morning to mid-afternoon, and then he'd go to the golf course the rest of the day. Had a nanny at our house. The nanny was raising us. Everything was going great. My dad's like, "Ah, I've got four kids. I've got a lovely wife. I've got a wonderful nanny. He's taking care of my kids. Beautiful golf course. Thriving private practice. I made it." This is a man who came from nothing. Came from extreme poverty. He worked hard to reach that American dream. And then one night, he was all excited. There's this new movie that came out, and he brought all of us to watch this brand new movie just released called Mary Poppins. My father shares that at one point during the movie, he's got tears coming down his face. He looks down the aisle at his wife and four children, and he realized that he is Mr. Banks. He's realizing that he is so focused on his career and having fun and all these things. And when my brother was dealing with some pretty difficult emotional times in that development, we were in California, and my father said, "What am I doing? My son is in need." And so my father quit his job, and he went off to Boston, moved all of us before he even had a job, because he had to do it for his son. He had to do it for his family. An unplanned interruption, a moment in his journey that he wasn't expecting, that made my father stop, reflect, and act. And right now, I am at that moment. This is my 14-year-old son. He was 6 days old when Michael and I flew down to Nashville, Tennessee, to adopt him. This was our fourth attempt in adoption. The first one was a scam. The other two changed their minds at the last minute after the child was born. And so we were a bit skeptical, uncertain, but we flew from Seattle to Nashville, and his mother met us. And we were at this hotel, and we were renting this like townhouse-looking thing. It was on the second floor, outside stairs down into this common area, and we were waiting for the call from the social worker. And then we got it. Social worker saying, "I'm here. Come meet your son." And those of us who are parents, we remember that moment, right? Whether it's hearing the heartbeat for the first time, whether it's seeing that beautiful child for the very first time. He was swaddled in this cloth. The social worker was this short white woman with long red hair. And then there was our sweet little Mason. Sweet little Mason. I want to read to you. I've kept a journal since his birth. And I want to read you just a passage from it. All right, Mason, it's Shabbat. And your family has gathered to celebrate you in a naming ceremony. We lit a fire, and we opened with the ringing of the meditation bowl, and a prayer was shared that you be blessed by your African ancestors and by the ancestors of your daddy and papa, and by the love of those gathered around you. Each person then took there was a pitcher of water that we were pouring into a chalice, and as they poured a little bit of water into the chalice, water that was from the River Jordan, a symbol of God's life-giving force in our lives, they said a blessing upon you. People said things such as, "May you be given strength and peace. You are such a blessing in our lives and family. Grow in wisdom." And then we each threw a bunch of cinnamon sticks onto the fire to add fragrance to our blessings. And after each person had said the blessing, I took that little cup, which is known as a Kiddush cup, and I used the water, and I blessed you and named you. For these past few months, you have brought us love, joy, and amazement into our lives, spiced with a few sleepless nights. All right, a lot of sleepless nights. It is our prayer that when you are able to read this journal, that you will be, that you will feel and see the love that we and God have for you. You are an amazing gift. You are a love song to be sung, and I look forward to every day watching you grow into the man that you are to become. Love, Papa. Eighth grade sucks. In these past few months, I have been struggling as I serve two houses, my family and the house of God, my family and this church. I've shared with different members of this church my struggles, the pastoral relations team and others, and I've come to that very difficult decision where I have to step down. Know that I do this with incredible pain in my heart because I would love to continue to journey as your pastor. It has brought me such incredible joy these past 2 years. But at the same time, I look at none of my accomplishments really matter if my child is without guidance. He needs me to be more physically and emotionally and spiritually present as he enters into high school. And I am extremely grateful for this church. And I understand how lucky Michael and I are to be in a financial place where we can support ourselves with one salary at the moment. A little sidebar. 21st ministry is hard on families. It's the old role model where you had one parent who was the pastor and then the other parent stayed home and helped take care of the kids and did all these things doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. And when I came to you 3 years ago, Mason was in a different place. And I was in a different place. And I'm going to miss creating moments with you. I'm going to miss Bible study. I'm going to miss sanctuary transformation. And I'm going to miss sharing historical tidbits, such as the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. This is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, originally built in the 300s, then burned down, and then rebuilt in the 500s. Just this little section, don't think about this yet, this little section is the original church born over what we believe is the birthplace of Jesus. These other churches were added on by different denominations over the course of centuries, and they argue. They argue. And I'm going to get to that in a moment. But the only way to get into the Church of the Nativity, if you go there today, is through this little teeny door. It's 4 feet tall. I think a few feet wide. If you notice, for those who have amazing eyes, there is an arch. I'm going to miss this. There is an arch right here. Can you see that? That's the original door. What happened was, in the year 1000 plus, marauders kept riding their horses into the church to rob it. So the church committee got together. What do we do? I think Lauren's ancestors were there. They said, hey, let's build a smaller door that a horse can't go through. That's a great idea. So they sealed up the main door, the only door that time going into the church, and made it so there's just a few feet tall for you to enter in. But this is a wonderful example of where a practical moment of preventing horses from getting into the sacred site is now one of spiritual meditation, where before we walk into the church where Christ was born, we are bowing. We are bowing with reverence as we enter into church. And I bow in reverence to all of you. I bow in reverence to have been your pastor for these times, welcoming me into your homes, into your journeys, into your pain and into your celebrations. And I will always, always hold this church in the depths of my heart. And I am thankful for the opportunities to serve. And now my attention goes to my son. And so thank you. I'll be with you for another couple months as we continue to celebrate and worship this amazing ministry that we have here at Suquamish United Church of Christ. Amen.